Hello and welcome to the November 2025 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynemouth area Talking Newspapers monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Let us find out what we have in store for you this month. John Townsend will be in conversation with Sophie Brimacombe and Margaret Swift, the co-chairs of Shaftesbury Theatre Dawlish. Part one of their conversation will appear in this programme, and part two will feature in the December programme. This will be followed by a piece of music. Fran Frank has put together another set of 10 quiz questions for you. The answers will appear towards the end of the programme. David Picton will share his poem entitled Drowned by My Own Hand. Norma Orty will be reading her story entitled Supper Club. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. We will then have a poem from Jenny Horton entitled Colours of Love. Valerie Forrester's son Neil Forrester will be reading an article about Powderham Castle. Fran Frank will be back with the answers to the quiz questions. Viv Wilson will be sharing the history of Tynemouth Pier in her segment One Foot in the Past. We will then conclude the programme with a piece of music. Here is John Townsend with his guests.
Hello, it's John Townsend again with another Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I get to chat with musicians, actors, singers, dancers, theatrical directors, and more besides who work and perform both locally and further afield. Now, my guests today are a bit of a double act, two for the price of one. A buy one, get free special offer, you could say, and they've popped over the road from the Shaftesbury Theatre, where they rule with rods of iron covered in glitter behind the velvet curtains. I'm pleased to welcome the power behind the footlights, the co-chair leaders of the Shaftesbury Theatre and the Dawlish Repertory Company. Thank you, Sophie Brimacombe and Margaret Swift, for joining me in the studio.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Great to have you here. And I will just say to listeners, there could be noises off because there's a bit of a party going on in Dawlish. And we've got the window open, so that's what you might hear in the background. Now, before you each tell us about some of the things that you have to manage over the road and maybe give us a few tasters as to what's coming to the theatre in the new season, I always start by asking guests the question, how did it all start? Now, by that, I don't necessarily mean becoming co-chair leaders, as you were probably nominated, then voted into the job before you had a chance to refuse. Or maybe I'm wrong and it's been a lifetime ambition. Either way, I'm interested in how and why you became interested and involved in amateur theatre in the first place. Is the stage in your DNA, or was there some wow experience that lit a spark and you couldn't resist throwing yourself into the dramatic world of am-drams, where, in my experience, there tends to be more drama going on off stage, in the wings and at committee meetings than actually on? You may agree. So maybe I could start with Sophie, whose association with the Shaftesbury goes back probably the longest. It's probably even where you learned to walk, Sophie. Do tell us some of your early memories of shows. Or, you know, how did you get started?
I started in 1998 with what was then Dawlish Operatic Amateur Society, with The Sound of Music, where I played Marta.
Oh.
And then I performed in my first pantomime in 1999, which was Aladdin, and I've done every single pantomime ever since, apart from the year that we didn't have one because of COVID.
Right, so you're a seasoned pantomime performer. Well, is it because of family connections, family involved there? Or
yes, my sisters were always in panto for a couple of years before me. We used to be part of our dance group that used to do the little ballet just before the interval. So, yeah, it's been quite a few years.
So in the pantomime coming up, I think I'm allowed to say it's Cinderella. you're involved in, well, I say that you're involved in the singing and dancing chorus work, but you never know what part you're going to land up with, because various pantomimes we've done, people have dropped out at the last minute and you've stepped in.
Yes, quite regularly. It's happened with quite a few plays as well. I've been known to learn a play in less than 24 hours, which was then entered into a competition.
Oh, really? So, what an all-rounder. Yeah. I seem to remember you had to step into a bear costume last year at the last minute.
Yes, I was a bear last year.
And I think the last thing I remember seeing you in was in Blythe Spirit.
Yes.
Was that a step-in part, or you you did audition?
I did kind of audition for that one, but that one I ended up being the stage manager, the prompt, I did props, I was in it. Yeah, I did quite a few hats on that one.
But it was a great little part to play, because you were running around like this frantic maid, weren't you? I can't remember her name now. But
Edith.
Okay, good. Well, let's thank you for that brief introduction with you, and you co-chair with Margaret Swift. Now, I don't know how long you've been living in Dawlish. You're perhaps a newcomer-ish, do you
see? I've only been here 20 years.
Oh, 20? Yes, oh, that's quite big. Yeah.
So, you know, I've got quite a long time to
go. So how long is your association with the Shaftesbury?
The Shaftesbury Theatre, I actually started hiring it for my lovely mum's birthday in January, where I used to hire it and show a film and invite all her friends. And the theatre.
What a lovely idea.
Absolutely brilliant, and the two people who helped out kept saying, "Oh, we need you, you must volunteer and I kept saying, "I will volunteer when I retire," not before. So when I retired from my full-time career in 2016, I was true to my word, and I volunteered, and I've been volunteering ever since.
And then you end up in the plum job, one might say.
Yes.
But have you performed?
I don't perform.
No.
I absolutely...
Even if we twist your arm, you
wouldn't. Could twist my arms, my legs, my ears, my whatever. But I do not perform. I am very definitely behind the scenes.
I think the first time...
And that's where I'm staying.
Well, never say never. I think the first time we... met was probably in the wings in a frock. I mean, I was in the frock.
Yes.
You may have been, I'm not sure, but as a dame. And you were a chaperone, I think. I seem to remember you with a clipboard.
Yes.
So you chaperoned the youngsters. So many jobs to do.
Well, at the moment I do, I co-chair, I'm the production secretary, I'm the assistant safeguarding lead, and I sort of lead on the chaperoning as well.
God.
So we all multitask.
Yeah,
you know.
I think you deserve a sainthood, really. I mean, there must be challenges. A little theatre like the Shaftesbury, which a lot of people are very affectionate about. It's a lovely space, isn't it? I mean, I know Tynemouth has its Ice Factory and the pavilions, but different atmospheres there. And I think the theatre is probably about 65 years old, or it'll have its 70th at the end of
1959.
So it's been there a while. And Sophie, you've known it for a while, and it's had a lot of changes, hasn't it?
It has. I was on the committee for both phases of the Shaftesbury Quest, where we put in disabled access and things. So, that it was hard work.
Yeah. And I mean, it must have had, I mean, technical side of things must have changed over the years. Yeah. I mean, maintenance, is that a big cost?
Yeah.
You have a rolling program of keeping things. I mean, it's, you know, you've got some good kit there, but it always needs replacing, doesn't it?
It's one of the things we've been concentrating on this year. Sophie and I have really focused on, if you like, succession planning, both personnel-wise and maintenance-wise. So we have actually developed a plan this year that the whole committee were involved in, and a few others as well, which we've been able to identify, you know, everything that's going to need to be doing over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
And we're going to the costing out and thinking about applying for funding.
Well, I was going to ask about that. Do you do you qualify for any grants?
Next project come September is I'm going to be looking at putting in funding bids for Arts Council, Lotto, for some of our bigger projects, because as you can imagine, things wear out.
Absolutely.
So we are, I think, now doing a lot more forward planning and thinking about, well, in the next 3 to 5 years, we are going to need to do A, B, C, and D.
Yeah, yeah.
How are we going to fund it? Let's look at what we're going to do with that.
Yes, but no major structural changes or?
Not major structural changes. No, it's no. All mainly internal. But if you think about the seats, for instance, huge auditorium, those seats are coming to their end of their life, and we've got to think about.
Yes, and they're not cheap.
They're not cheap. No.
Where did they come from originally? Do you know?
I think they came from somewhere near Paignton.
I mean, it's just amazing how the theatre has sort of developed and grown. And to keep, I don't know how many productions you do a year, plays.
We do 4 plays and the panto.
Right. Now, we'll talk about that in a moment. Yes. Or maybe in our next little segment that we do. But I think a new thing is that you've been doing films. Both the theatre and the Tynemouth Film Society. So that must be... Is that a risk financially? Because do you have to cover certain costs with tickets? Do any make a loss, is what I'm saying?
No, we do know because we do analyse all the data. So we do know. So we have the Tuesday afternoon films, which are the rep films.
Yeah.
And we do know they either break even or we make a tiny, tiny amount on that. Our main aim is to break even because it's more of a social
thing,
for... the clientele that come on a Tuesday afternoon. Yeah. Tynemouth Film Society, they actually hire the theatre, if you like. Yeah. They pay us an annual cost.
Do,
and they organise and run all that themselves.
Right.
So,
And how do you select the films out of interest?
So we actually do talk to our clientele who come on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
We, every so often, we'll have a session where we'll ask them for their ideas, or we'll put ideas to them. We'll say, we're thinking of doing this, 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 and this. What do you think? So it's a two-way process.
Yeah,
it works
you probably
well.
Don't know the answer to this question, but I'm interested that some of our listeners with sight loss do like to go to cinema and have audio description, and some films do come with an audio description facility.
Same.
Do you know in advance if that's the case? Are you able to do anything with headphones, or is that yet to be explored?
I think that's yet to be explored, and it is something that
I would. I mean, I know pavilions do some films, but very often they don't know until the last minute if they are able to use it. So it doesn't really help our listeners to plan. But,
I need to speak to somebody at the pavilion centre to find out what they do. Yes.
But no, that's something, again, with plays. We've been talking to our listeners about, and we've gone to various theatres doing not just audio description, but what they call touch tours. So somebody with sight loss can come before a production, feel the set, sometimes meet the actors, maybe touch some of the props. When we did it recently down in Torquay, and it was just great because, you know, it helps. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, that's something to think about.
Absolutely.
Now, I'd like to get on to talking about some exciting things coming up at the Shaftesbury in the year ahead. But I think we're running a bit tight on time for today's programme. So I'm going, and of course we're going to ask you for a piece of music next time. So can I just say for the time being, thank you very much for your input, and we look forward to hearing a little bit more next time.
Here is the song Tears, sung by Ken Dodd. The song, also known as Tears for Souvenirs, was written by lyricist Frank Capano and composer Billy Ure, and first sung by Rudy Valli in 1930. Ken Dodd's version was recorded as a single in 1965 and became a number one hit in the UK singles chart.
Tears for souvenirs are all you left me. Memories of a love you never meant. I just can't believe you could forget me. After all those happy hours we spent together, tears have been my only consolation. But tears can't mend a broken heart, I must confess. Let's forgive and forget, turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness. Tears have been my only consolation, but tears can't mend a broken heart, I must confess. Let's forgive and forget, turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness. Let's forgive and forget, turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness.
It's now over to Fran Frank.
Hello again. Are you sitting comfortably? Then let's begin this month's general knowledge quiz. As usual, there will be 10 questions followed by 3 possible answers. So let's get going with question 1. Antarctic explorer Captain Robert Scott shared his middle name with which bird of prey? Was it A, eagle, B, harrier, or C, falcon? Question 2. What body of water lies between the United Kingdom and Norway? Is it A, the Norwegian Sea, B, the English Channel, or C, the North Sea? Question 3. Who was the second man to set foot on the moon? Was it A, Edwin Buzz Aldrin, B, Neil Armstrong, or C, Alan Shepard? Question 4. In which county in England is the National Arboretum located? Is it A, Cumbria, B, Surrey, or C, Gloucestershire? Question 5. How many vowels does a modern trumpet have? Is it A, 4, B, 3, or C, 2? Question 6. What was the name of the TV detective played by Telly Savalas in the 70s? Was it A. Banacek, B. Rockford, or C. Kojak? Question 7. What was the most popular name for girls born in 2024? Was it A. Catherine, B. Olivia, or C. Taylor? Question 8. In which year did third class rail travel officially end in the UK? Was it A. 1936, B. 1946, or C. 1956? Question 9. Colombo is the commercial capital of which tea-producing island country? Is it A. Indonesia, B. Sri Lanka, or C. Vietnam? Question 10. What is the name of a triangular tract of sediment at a river's mouth and the fourth letter of the Greek alphabet? Is it A. Delta, B. Delft, or C. Dalet? Ten assorted questions with various options for you to think about. I'll return towards the end of the programme with the correct answers. Enjoy the rest of the programme.
Here is David Picton with his poem for this month.
Drowned by my own hand and swallowed by the slow stream. Somnambulant water sends the sunlight scurrying to ripple over tree roots, cooling their feet. Fishes snake carelessly waking soft silt that wishes only to return to bed, too listlessly warm in the afternoon's quietening embrace. A lonely heron disguises itself as though alabaster statue, leg raised. Stillness reflects on the surface as what little breeze loses breath until the next. Leaning over, poplin sky and dagger-drawn branches are interrupted by an inquiring face. Wondering eyes appear, then disappear at the whim of the wind. Hands dive into the glassy cold water, scattering shards of light, releasing the reflections it thought it had captured there. I look for myself, but I am gone, drowned by the thirsty curiosity of my own hand and swallowed by the slow stream.
We now have a story from Norma Orty.
Supper Club. Jane and her husband John were retired and comfortably financed by their pensions and legacies from their parents. John enjoyed golf and had a circle of friends with whom he played each Thursday. Their rounds ended in the club restaurant where they enjoyed a meal. Jane had a group of lady friends who belonged to a gym, a book club, and a walking group. Their meetings ended with a visit to a tea or coffee shop or a wine bar before going to their respective homes. In a magazine, Jane had read about supper clubs. groups of like-minded foodie friends would all go to a restaurant once a month, or they established their own club and met in their homes. One evening after a particularly good meal, Jane brought up the subject. "John, dear, we have many friends who would appreciate that dish. Let us invite some of them to come here." "A lot of work for you," he said, knowing her to be a perfectionist. Jane thought for a moment. "Well, I could share the load. Val is very good with starters. Mary creates beautiful salads, and Susan's vegetables are also always so imaginative. All that we would do is provide the venue and the main dish." "What about something to finish?" asked John. "Something gooey or chocolatey." He was known for his love of desserts, ice creams and puddings. "Well, there is a new member of our walking group, younger than most, but very trendy. I'll ask her to bring the dessert, and her fiancé." John left Jane to give the invitations for the chosen evening. 5 couples were on the list, making a round dozen with their hosts. Their house had a fantastic entertaining area. The dark wood of the long table reflected the crystal chandeliers and beautiful flowers. The guests arrived on time and were invited to an aperitif at the bar, which was John's pride and joy. The newcomers, Lynn and Michael, were most affable and fitted in despite being but younger. As 8 was chimed by the grandfather clock, John showed everyone to their seats. Val's elegant starter was well received. It was followed by Jane's special lamb dish, accompanied by Susan's colourful veggies. Lynn had made a traditional apple pie, served with the unusual cinnamon cream, which she said was her grandmother's recipe. Over coffee, the happily smiling group decided unanimously that they would like to hold their supper club once a month, each couple to host in turn and provide the main dish, others to take their turn to provide the rest of the meal or have a rest. The supper club evolved very well. Lynn, as the youngest, blossomed. She loved meeting, and they did well when they hosted in their modest home. It had come round once more for her to provide the dessert. She proudly brought it to the table. Something chocolatey and yummy, especially for John, she joked. A fragrant baked pudding accompanied by a luscious caramel sauce was served and savoured by all. After coffee, everyone settled in the lounge. The minister's wife praised Lynn's pudding and asked for the recipe. Lynn said that it was Michael's and it had been very popular at uni. Always a relaxing finale to a meal. So warming. "Yes, I can feel that myself," said the minister with a little giggle. Very soon, all 12 of them were as merry as could be. However, one member was deep in thought. William, a retired chief constable, was wondering if this would be the last supper.
That reminded me of a cooking club I was a member of years ago. We'd take turns to cook a main course only. The others would bring the drinks. It was quite enjoyable, really. Were you involved in something similar? It's now time for Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor to review the book they have read for this month's programme.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I are looking at The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Spanish, by a gentleman, which is all terribly obvious in you reading it. But I was absolutely hooked. I sat and started it while I had my coffee one morning with the washing machine thundering away, and I could barely put it down. It's just totally engrossing. It's intriguing. It's got everything in that men write about, in the way that men write about things. But it was marvellous.
Okay, well, we're in Barcelona.
It is 1930s, 1940s time, so Spanish Civil War blows up in the middle of this. And it's a very peculiar story, really, all about booksellers and authors and publishers and a horrible police officer. And it's
incredibly dark.
Very dark, but completely unbelievable. And yet, it's, as you say, completely gripping from start to finish. Wonderful characters. It's partly a thriller, partly a mystery story. There's a lot of romance in there. It is, as you say, the women are basically just objects for the men to enjoy, which, you know, perhaps speaks to its time as much as anything. But it is just a rattling good story, and it's very, quite complex. Lots and lots of different characters, some marvellous characters. Very well written. You know, in every way, it's just a good thumping read.
Really is. But no, as to the characters, there are a lot of characters. But the brilliance of the writing is you didn't lose track. You never lost sight of who was who and who was talking about whom. It was just a wonderful story to read. Also, a story about a man who wrote books and searching his story, searching the narrator's story, and everybody else you came across. Each story linked, but beautifully executed. Totally engrossing. I can't say enough about a book which I was nervous of to start with.
Yeah, me too. Well, it was recommended to me, and someone just said, just go for it. You know, you will like it. It's preposterous, but it's unbelievably great. It is. Lots and lots of little secrets. So there's all kinds of reveals that happen towards the end of the book, you know, long, all kinds of little things, little twists that you really didn't see coming. There's one I did see coming, slightly, I think, I wasn't surprised by, but generally speaking, they were, oh, my goodness, I didn't realise that person was related to that person in that way and so on. Very original as well. The setting is original. Gothic, a little bit of magic in there. There's this place called the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, which is a sort of mysterious place that only some people know about. Does it exist? Sometimes there are characters and you're not sure whether they're ghosts or real. You know, it's just so much in there. So many different genres sort of thrown together. And it just, of course, makes it really interesting.
And there are amusing characters. There are totally depressing characters, beautiful people, incredibly ugly people. And you can, in your mind's eye, you can see all this. It's just beautifully portrayed. I think this has got to be one of the books we've raved over more than any of the ones we've done this year.
Well, it's a massive hit as well. It was published in 2001 in Spain, and it's, you know, sold squillions, millions and millions of copies all around the world, translated into all different languages. So a lot of people love it.
And also, you're saying about it of its time, you're saying when it was published and written, but it's actually looking back to before the life of this author was born. And so having that vision and that research and the construction to do that, to interlink everything, is just amazing.
Yeah. And the politics is interesting too, because it is during the Spanish Civil War. So we have this inspector, this police officer, who's a complete psychopath, really, who gets into a position of great authority and then basically kind of runs the city in his own terms, using violence and intimidation.
Incredible violence.
And I don't think that's, I'm not sure that's that unreal. I think there were people like that around.
Well, yes, I actually found that very believable and acceptable of the time, because the Civil War in Spain was notorious for those types of actions. But he was a young man before that time, and he was influenced by his youth.
Yeah, there's lots of sexual jealousy.
That's
and
where
going
all these
here.
Little links yeah. come in. It's marvellous.
Okay, well, next month we are going to be looking at a very, very different kind of book. This one is another huge, recent, popular bestseller. It's called Small Pleasures, and the author is Claire Chambers. So we'll be reading that and bringing our review to you in the December roundabout.
Mary and Stephen have just discussed the book The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobook. Here is Jenny Horton with her poem.
This poem is about embracing all cultures and all the nations of this world. Colours of love. We all share the different colours of life, all the shades from black to white. We all feel the cold of the wind and the rain. We all share emotions of laughter and pain. We all share the joy of a newborn babe. We all feel grief when life slips away. There is no discrimination to the color of your skin. We all feel passion of our love within. We all share the different colors of life. The softness of a voice when it whispers goodnight. The passion of a hug when you hold someone tight. The joy of love and the gift of life. We all share the different colors of life. All the shades from black to white. The color in your heart, your soul, and your mind. When we fall in love, the color is blind. Love is blind to the color of your kiss. Love is blind to the softness of your lips. Love is blind to the color of your hair. The colors of love are everywhere. We all share the shades that bless our spirit. We all share the colors of love. There's no limit. Love comes in all colors, from black to white. When we love one another, there is no wrong or right. To the shade of your skin or the color of your heart, if we embrace all our colors, our world will have peace and not be torn apart.
We now have Neil Forrester with an article about Pardrum Castle, which featured in the August edition of the Devon Life magazine. Neil was guest editor of the magazine. The article is called Through the Keyhole by Chrissy Harris. She visited Pardrum Castle to find out what it is like to live in such an extraordinary family home. It has been 10 years since Charles Courtenay, 19th Earl of Devon, inherited Pardrum Castle.
Watching way too much television, going out on biking adventures, hanging out with the neighbours. It sounds like Charles Courtenay did the same stuff we all did growing up in the 80s and 90s, except he lived in a castle. As he sips coffee out of his favourite rainbow enamel mug, the Earl of Devon, dressed in jeans and Adidas trainers, hardly needs to explain that he often felt a bit awkward about that as a kid. I mean, it was a really good home as a teenager because in the summer you could have friends come and stay, but as I've said this before, it's always a bit embarrassing, he says. I had a great friend called Ben who lived in the village at the end of the drive, and his dad would always go to the pub, and I thought, wouldn't that be nice? Charles, or Charlie, Courtenay, has tried not to let Pardrum go to his head. The down-to-earth earl and barrister has always known what a privilege it is to be custodian of one of the most historic estates in Devon. But that it's also hard work. Since he inherited Pardrum from his father, Hugh Courtenay, in August 2015, Charlie has been keen to build on its foundations as an entertaining family home, throwing open the house and grounds for guided tours, concerts, festivals, weddings and more. There's a photo shoot for a tent catalogue taking place on the grass by the courtyard today. That's what I think is amazing about Pardrum, says Charlie. It was built as a home over 600 years ago, with that great hall as a space to entertain on a grand scale. It was made to look romantic and gothic and exciting. People come here for that sense of wow. Doesn't it feel impressive? Doesn't it feel exciting? It's doing exactly the same thing today as it's always done. Charlie's early childhood was spent living with his parents in Pardrum's red brick stable house, visiting his grandparents in the castle, and exploring the 3,500 acres of parkland and 3 miles of estuary foreshore. In the 1990s, Charlie moved into the main house with his parents and three elder sisters. My family were very horsey, but I wasn't particularly, so I spent a lot of time watching TV, says Charlie. Everyone worries today about their kids stuck on screens, but I just sat and watched Bagpuss and whatever was on. I was a huge consumer of TV. Despite such normal pastimes, Charlie knew what was in store for him from an early age, and that powderum would one day be his way of life. A lot of decisions I took professionally, becoming a barrister and such, was with a view to having something that would be flexible while I did this, he says. I also felt I needed to bring something to Powderham in terms of income. Like many stately homes, Powderham struggled financially through the 20th century and opened its doors to the public in the 1950s to help meet the huge maintenance costs. It was hard for my dad and his parents, says Charlie. My dad grew up in Powderham after the Second World War and knew it as a private home. The opening of the doors to defray the cost, I think it always felt to him like an assault on their privacy. Whereas I've grown up with it as an open space, I think I'm more relaxed with it. Sharing his home is clearly second nature to Charlie, and he happily takes us through the stately but relaxed private wing of Powderham where he lives with his children aged 18 and 15. Charlie recently split from his wife, the American actor A.J. Langer. She now lives in California, and the couple's children currently divide their time between the U.S. and the U.K. These modest rooms feel softer than the rest of the house, with comforting signs of family life. A creakingly full fridge is in the kitchen. Charlie loves to cook. A saucer full of Quality Street is on the kitchen table. Vinyl album covers, including Vanilla Ice, carefully displayed on the dining room wall. The kids' early drawings, holiday snaps. It's all in sharp contrast to the perfectly preserved Georgian rooms and a nationally important Rococo staircase across the hall. To Charlie, however, it's all home sweet home. Can he relax here? Oh yeah, but there's always stuff you could be doing. I mean, just look around, he says, glancing around his dining room. It's lovely, but you can see where there's paint peeling off. I suppose everybody gets home and there's a lawn to mow or a gutter to fix. Yes, it's on a slightly bigger scale here, and there are some fabulous people to help you do stuff, but it doesn't ever relax. One of the latest projects has involved clearing Powderham's attic rooms of decades of clutter, some highly valuable both financially and sentimentally. Powderham's full of treasures, says Charlie, as he leads me and photographer Steve up the creaky stairs to these incredible, untouched-for-years rooms, known as the 30s, because of their numerical order in the house. That's been a stress and a challenge over the past couple of months, but I think we're there, Charlie continues. There's an energetic aspect to shifting stuff on and giving it a new life. Piles of old Country Life magazines, a giant bell, a Royal Wessex yeomanry helmet. There's still quite a lot of stuff up there. I never really wanted to sell anything, and I've struggled with it, but I want to use these rooms, says Charlie. We want to make some more accommodation spaces available. We keep going up and up, and then onto the recently improved roof with its new copper and crenellations. What a treat this is. The recently improved roof with its beautiful stonework, and then the uninterrupted views out over the estuary are amazing. It makes one feel rather contemplative. What's next for Powderham? Are Charlie's kids going to take it on? Do you know, that's up to them, he says. My aim is to make something they would like to take on, and also, quite deliberately, I wanted them to grow up and have a life outside of Powderham, which obviously they've got. It's not you must do this or else, which I slightly felt. I was very much brought up to be, this is your duty and it's going to be hard. It's not easy, of course, but the idea is to make this a vibrant, viable enterprise they can pick up and run with if they choose. We make our way back downstairs, where the next tour of the house has just started. The people listening to their guide probably have no idea that the casually dressed, 6-foot-6-inch gentleman showing us out is the current owner and the future of this local landmark. He's doing a pretty good job so far.
Are you ready for the answers to the quiz questions? It's over to Fran Frank.
How do you think you managed? Did you get most of them right? Or were some of them just out of reach? Anyway, let's find out what the actual answers are. Question 1. Antarctic explorer Captain Robert Scott shared his middle name with which bird of prey? The answer was C. Falcon. Question 2. What body of water lies between the United Kingdom and Norway? The answer was C, the North Sea. Question 3. Who was the second man to set foot on the moon? It was A, Edwin Buzz Aldrin. Question 4. In which county in England is the National Arboretum located? The answer was C, Gloucestershire. Question 5. How many valves does a modern trumpet have? The answer was B, 3. Question 6. What was the name of the TV detective played by Telly Savalas in the 1970s? The answer was C, Kojak. Question 7. What was the most popular name for girls born in 2024? The answer was B, Olivia. Question 8. In which year did third class rail travel officially end in the United Kingdom? The answer was C, 1956. Question 9. Colombo is the commercial capital of which tea-producing island country? The answer was B, Sri Lanka. And finally, question 10. What is the name of a triangular tract of sediment at a river's mouth and the fourth letter of the Greek alphabet? And it's not the brook in Dawlish. The answer, as most of you will have guessed, was A, Delta. Well, that's it for November's General Knowledge Quiz. I hope you've enjoyed the challenge and look forward to offering you another batch of questions in December. Bye.
Viv Wilson is here with her segment, One Foot in the Past. This month, Viv shares with us the history of Tynmouth Pier. Earlier on, Neil Forrester was talking about Powderham Castle and the current Earl of Devon. Incidentally, one of his forebears is mentioned in the history of Tynmouth Pier.
Try and imagine that you're on Tynmouth seafront and there's a group of men looking rather important, all dressed in dark clothes, some of them wearing top hats. and they look as if there's something about to happen. Well, in fact, the year was 1865, and something was about to happen. One of these very smart, important men was the Earl of Devon, and it was his special task that day to drive the first pile into the sand for the building of Tynemouth Pier. This was a highly ambitious project. It's one that would take 2 years to build. It would stretch 600 feet out into the sea, and it would cost £8,000 to build. A real enterprise trying to elevate this seaside resort of Tynemouth. The design had been worked up by Mr. J.W. Wilson. I'd love to say he was a forebear, but sadly he wasn't. But he had been a pupil at the Crystal Palace School of Engineering, and he'd worked out the design for this wonderful structure, one of the very earliest in the country. The piles had been fitted with screw blades. I suppose they must have looked a bit like a fan or a fin or something of that sort that could be pushed down right through the sand until they reached the level of clay, and thus provide a very stable base for the construction of the pier building itself atop the length of piles. Following the official opening by the chairman of the local board, which was the pre-runner of the Urban District Council, it meant that steamships with passengers coming from Lyme Regis, from Exmouth, from Torbay, even from Plymouth, could stop off at Tynemouth by landing at the end of the pier and then walking its 600-foot length and come down onto the promenade or even venture into the town. It was really exciting, but just bear in mind that that early pier had got no features on it other than seats running the whole length. The second installation were various ornamental arches running its length, and the centre of each of the arch was a beautiful circular crystal glass globe, which was became a gas lamp. So at night it must have been so romantic to see it all lit up. At the landward end were four pagodas forming a very impressive entrance to the pier, and lots of adverts were scattered across the top, you know, for local businesses. And the Victorians who fancied a slice of ozone but didn't want to take a sea voyage, they would pay one penny at the turnstile in order to promenade along the length of the pier and not only enjoy that but the panorama as well, because it would have been absolutely stunning and a wonderful viewpoint to look back towards the seafront buildings and see all the new architecture stretching along the Den and away towards St Michael's Church. Gradually, the commercial opportunities were exploited. Selling of refreshments, maybe ice creams and drinks, and little bits of informal entertainment. Then the installation of machines offering such delights as what the butler saw. And this grew as time went on. It should be remembered that the only other pier in existence at this time was on the Isle of Wight's, I think it's called Blackdown Chine. That was the first, and Tynemouth was the very second one to be built that was meant to be an opportunity for an amusement arcade within the structure. After 10 years, it was being written about in the Tynemouth Journal of 1875, and a rather pompous article says that we who live locally are really very proud of our wonderful scenery, of our hills, of our seafront, our outlooks, etc. And I would have included the pier, but no, not in its present condition. It's certainly not worth mentioning at all. So, you see, there was people making observations back in 1875. Now, as then, the reality is that any structure standing with its feet in the sea full time is going to need tremendous amount of maintenance, invariably way and beyond any reasonable amount of investment. It's just the way of things. Ownership changed hands in 1887, and Mr. Denby bought it and had this fantastic idea of uprooting it, lock, stock, barrel and what the butler saw, and re-erecting it in Paignton. Fantastic idea. But when he worked out how much it would cost, he abandoned the idea. Nothing surprising there. He decided on another course of action. The following season, he erected a large tent at the seaward end of the pier, and one of the offers was for entertainment by the First Rifle Volunteers playing a concert of music and followed by dancing to the sounds of a string band. I reckon he was testing the market to see if it was worthwhile investing in having a permanent ballroom at the end of the pier. Well, sure enough, a couple of years later, he has a pavilion erected with 300 seats in it, and it could be used for all manner of entertainment and dancing and concerts and shows. On top of that, he had a footbridge erected, 35 feet long, at the far end of the pier, so this was connecting with the landing stage so that as the steamships drew up, the passengers could disembark onto the landing stage, up the bridge and onto the ballroom or round the outsides and along the pier back to land. Additional entertainments in the pavilions, magic lantern slideshows, and then a little later on, movie shows by a family called Max, usually shows depicting cowboys and Indians. So it was all go on the entertainment front. But probably the most popular feature was the oval-shaped dance floor in the pavilion, and it was of sprung walnut and claimed to be one of the finest in the area. So many people made memories on Tynmouth Pier, dancing away to a romantic melody and then walking out underneath the moon and the stars arm in arm and possibly leading towards a marriage before too long. Over the years, an amazing array of varied entertainment took place. There were fashion shows and talent competitions, all manner of things to add to the ever popular dancing. And apparently there was a tradition sprung up that every Boxing Day people were allowed to go into the ballroom and roller skate on it. Seems very odd to me, but there it was. It happened. The Teen Corinthian Yacht Club established a headquarters there on the pier, and later on the Swimming and Life-Saving Club that were responsible for staging many very popular water polo matches next to the pier. They had their wooden hut as an HQ, and apparently burly swimmers made a spectacular appearance by dropping down through a trapdoor in the bottom of the pier onto the beach, much to the amazement of anybody nearby. Over the years, it was subjected to numerous storms. One of the most spectacular and damaging was in January of 1908, when it was so fierce that the entrance part of the pier, where the four pagodas were, just collapsed virtually, concertinaed and collapsed onto the beach, costing a huge amount to repair. And so time goes on. Nothing really changes. It always needs a huge amount of maintenance, far and away beyond what is realistically able to be found to spend on it. And bearing in mind that we as an island race know that the sea is both friend and enemy. I'm afraid the reality is that the sea's salty tongue licks away at any structure at all made by we puny humans. And so it goes on. But over the years, so many people have had reason to find joy because of the presence of the pier. And so, at this stage in her life, all this time after her opening in 1867, I look across at her and think, well, she's like a faded grand old lady. But we love her, she's part of our scenery, and I just hope that they find a way of keeping her going. It's an ongoing task for the family who are charged with the responsibility of it. There is no public funding. There is no council backing. They have to keep their heads above the waves themselves. So we do wish them luck, and God bless Tynmouth's dear old Grand Pier.
Our final piece of music is Conga del Fuego Nuevo by Mexican composer Arturo Marquez and conducted by Gustavo Dudamel with the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela. Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guests Sophie Brimacombe and Margaret Swift, Fran Frank, David Picton, Norma Orty, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Jenny Horton, Neil Forrester and Viv Wilson. Thanks also to Jenny Horton for helping me with the copy and dispatch, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.